not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. Abigail Adams to John Adams, 31 March, 1776.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today, in honor of Women's History Month, we're going to focus on one famous woman's thoughts about the Declaration of Independence and the early United States. But before I tell you who that woman is, let's start with a trivia question, presidential trivia. Only two women in American history have been both the wife of a president and the mother of another president. Who are they? Well, Barbara Bush is one, wife of George W. and mother of George H.W. Bush. And the other woman is the subject of our series episode today, Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, the second president and mother of John Quincy Adams. However, describing Abigail Adams as merely a wife and a mother to two presidents does a serious disservice to her own life, her own political thoughts, and her own impact on American history. Indeed, Abigail Adams was an influential and inspirational figure in early American history, not just for women, but for the nation as a whole. One reason we know about all of her exceptional qualities is through the enormous collection of Adams family correspondence preserved by the Massachusetts Historical Society. Abigail's correspondence with her husband alone consists of about 1,200 letters, and in these letters we get a glimpse of the power and brilliance of one of the most important Americans in the Revolutionary period. So today, for Women's History Month, we're going to explore the life and ideas of Abigail Adams. Who was she? What was her relationship with John like? What did she think about the Declaration of Independence? What did she think about the war? What were her views on important issues affecting the early United States, from slavery to women's rights? And what can we learn today from examining Abigail Adams' life 250 years ago? I'm very happy today to have an expert guest with me from the Adams Family Papers Project at the Massachusetts Historical Society, editor and historian Hobson Woodward. Welcome, Hobson.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Hobson is series editor of the Adams Family Correspondence Series at the Adams Papers Project of the Massachusetts Historical Society, where he has worked since 2002. He is the author of A Brave Vessel, The True Tale of the Castaways Who Rescued Jamestown, and inspired Shakespeare's The Tempest, and links to Hobson's book, as well as the fantastic Adams Papers digital archive, are in the show notes. So, Hobson, as we get started there, I mentioned a little bit already about what do we know about Abigail Adams' political beliefs, and in that quotation that you mentioned, what we seem to see here is a very strong advocacy for women's rights, specifically using the language of the Declaration of Independence and some of the grievances in there, like, we will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation, which sounds a lot like the grievances that the Founding Fathers had against King George.
I agree with you. She loved that John was in Philadelphia and proceeding with the Declaration. It was a few months away, but she was on board with it. And placing her in the time, some have suggested that this was her statement in her letter to John was a little bit in jest, perhaps, but in another way, it was deadly serious. There's no question about it. It was a private statement. It was not made publicly, but she meant what she said. And it would inspire people for generations to come, really.
Right. You said that it was a private statement, and you indicated that this is not necessarily a sentiment that could be expressed at the time publicly. But there is some sort of, I don't know, some sort of principle that she expresses there that, again, we see in the Declaration of Independence, that you cannot write laws for people who have no say in them. And that's, I think, the deadly serious part of it, as you mentioned, right?
Absolutely. Her husband was really a titan of independence for the nation. And she was using the tropes that were often in conversation, but the world being what it was then, they were mostly in private letters that she was making these statements at this point. Maybe, I mean, the Adamses were particular about saving their correspondence, and they saved a lot. We have, as you mentioned, a lot here at the Mass Historical Society, about 250,000 pages in total in the Adams Papers collection. They knew they were saving them, and they knew people would read them in the future. So maybe that's what she had in mind.
Writing for posterity, because women's voices in public discourse were indeed limited. You mentioned the Adams Papers Project. Why don't we just take the opportunity now for you to just introduce to the audience here the fantastic collection you have. And also, I might mention how fantastically easy it is to search the digital archive for whatever you want. So why don't you just introduce our audience to the fantastic Adams Papers?
Yes, I would invite everybody to visit the Massachusetts Historical Society website. It's masshist.org, and there we have the work that we've done for the last 50 years or so. I'd like to say that we're in the breadcrumb business. We like to leave breadcrumbs for historians so that they can use these materials to write the histories of all facets of American life. We have a staff of 8. Our job is to transcribe to the very best of our ability the letters of the Adams family and John Adams's political letters and John Quincy Adams's political letters and lightly annotate them and present them to the public, both interested members of the public and historians, to use however they would like to use them.
And I might just add that not only have you started digitizing the images of the actual letters, which is indeed difficult to read, but it's just great that you can see the images, but also there are transcriptions with all of the wonderful misspellings of the period. Well, I don't know if there were misspellings at the time, but there are digital copies for ease of reading for those of you who can't read cursive written in the 1770s. It's really a fantastic digital archive. And for those of you paying attention to the series, you should definitely go there. Okay, let's move on just to talk a little bit about Abigail Adams' early life before she becomes Abigail Adams. So what was her childhood like?
She grew up in Weymouth, Massachusetts. She was the daughter of a congregational minister, and she had no formal schooling, but she spent a lot of time in his library. She was a voracious reader throughout her life. She read literature, she read newspapers, she read commentary, and her letters are full of her discussions of those subjects. When she grew up, after she married John, while he was in Philadelphia or away as a lawyer, she ran the family farm. And some of the more exceptional things she did was she invested and handled her own funds, which is pretty unusual for the time. And she really became John Adams's most trusted and valued advisor in his political life. She was really brilliant, a brilliant tactician and student of politics, and she loved to talk about it.
Great. So, but let's just focus a little bit more on that childhood. So she did not receive a formal schooling, but her father, being a minister, ensured that she could read and write, which we do see in her letters, references to Shakespeare and all sorts of literary and historical figures. How did she come about to meet John, though?
He was a local lawyer, and they lived in close proximity to each other, and just met in the course of daily life. There are some wonderful courtship letters in the Adams Papers. There is a letter which we know as the Miss Adorable letter, and it's John Adams writing to Abigail Adams on the 4th of October, 1762, when he was a young lawyer. And he's playing on the fact that he was a lawyer. He says, "Miss Adorable, by the same token that the bearer hereof sat up with you last night, I hereby order you to give him as many kisses and as many hours of your company after 9 o'clock as he shall please to demand, and charge them to my account.
That's sweet.
Yeah, the letters are full of very wonderful, intimate moments like that that really make the family come alive. It's fascinating to read them, I must say.
Yeah, the one thing that I've noticed in the letters between them is the mixture of practicality and genuine love and concern for the business that they're sharing. I was struck in many of the letters at the start of the revolutionary period between 1775 and 1776. You know, John Adams is doing significant things with Congress, but at the same time, John is very interested in the real basic stuff happening at the household. And Abigail is informing him about the state of the smallpox in the family and who's getting inoculated. And you just get this wonderful sense of how, as John Adams is shaping the future of America, Abigail is essentially making sure that everything is under control so he can continue with his work. But they don't write to each other as anything except absolute equals. Is that your sense from their correspondence too?
Yes, you literally took the words out of my mouth, that it required the cooperation of both of them. And that's one way that they are really exceptional. They treated each other as complete equals. And it's sometimes reading their letters and writing about them, it's easy to forget that they lived so long ago. I mean, you don't have to look any farther than their son, John Quincy, and his wife, Louisa Catherine Adams. Louisa did not participate in political discussions with her husband. It was a much more formal relationship.
That's interesting. So your argument is that, in fact, it's a very unique relationship that Abigail and John had for the period.
Yes. There are a few others. I'm thinking of Mercy Otis Warren and her husband, but it's unusual, I believe.
Okay, so she meets John, they get married, they start having kids. How is it then that John starts getting into politics from his time as a lawyer, and how is Abigail influencing or supporting that political career?
Well, he becomes a member, he's elected to the Continental Congress, and that's really where it begins. And actually, Abigail, at the beginning of the revolution, is in Quincy. Really, one of my favorite letters is when she describes to him the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Let me just set the scene for the audience. So the British Army is stationed in Boston at the time. We're talking April 1775. The British Army has word that there are stockpiles of arms out in the countryside outside of Boston. And so the British Army goes out to try to confiscate these weapons. And this is the night of Paul Revere's ride, where he warns the militiamen that the British regiments are coming out. And then we get the first battles of the war, Lexington and Concord. Now, as the British Army retreats back to Boston after the battles of Lexington and Concord, now we're getting to this Battle of Bunker Hill. And just a quick question, is Abigail living in Boston at the time, or have they fled to the countryside because Boston is basically an armed camp? Is that correct?
They were living on the South Shore at the time, yes.
Outside of Boston.
Outside of Boston, yes.
Right. Okay, so now we get to the Battle of Bunker Hill. Why don't you tell us about this, Dow Hobson?
She takes her 8-year-old son, John Quincy Adams, to the top of a local hill, Penn's Hill in Quincy, and they watch the smoke from the battle. It's up in Boston, Charlestown, just across the Charles River from Boston, but they can hear it and they can see the smoke. And she later wrote to her husband on the 18th of June, 1775, the day, perhaps the decisive day, has come on which the fate of America depends. My bursting heart must find vent at my pen. Charlestown is laid in ashes. The battle began upon our entrenchments upon Bunker's Hill, a Saturday morning at 3 o'clock, and has not ceased yet. Their good friend, Dr. Joseph Warren, died in the battle. She knows that There's no going back at this point. So you can sense her worry for her family and for her husband and for her nation.
Yeah, a couple of interesting things about that. First, what was something of a not a common practice, but it happened quite often that civilians would spectate at battles, which was very common, well, pretty common in Europe. But it was something that one could do, sort of observe a battle from far away, which
Indeed.
Doesn't seem like the day out that we would have with our kids in 2026, but oh, so be it.
Indeed.
The second point that I'd like to make, though, is something of a conflict that John Adams, along with Abigail Adams, had with many members of Congress, and we see this in future letters. They complain quite a bit about the fact that Congress can't get its act together to declare independence now until basically a year after the Battle of Bunker Hill, right?
That's true.
And so here what we see is Abigail is saying, you know, this is Bunker Hill is the impulse for independence. We're seeing the British Army laying waste to our city. Now we have to declare independence, but it takes a long time until independence actually happens.
You are correct. I mean, they were, you could say, committing treason, so there may have been some good reason for the reluctance, but yes. And those debates in the Continental Congress are spread out in the family letters that John writes. When John Adams and his colleagues in the Continental Congress declared it an independent nation, John wrote to Abigail and predicted it'll be celebrated with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other. His only problem was he thought it would be July 2nd, because that's when the actual passage took place, but it was proclaimed on the 4th, and it became the 4th, so he was very accurate in his description, just a little off on the date.
Yeah, I have that passage in front of me. The second day of July 1776 will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. As it is, it ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. And now I want to stop here because of that solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty phrase. You mentioned that Abigail was raised by a minister. Here we see in this passage this reference to solemn acts of devotion to God. Can you describe a little bit the importance of religion for Abigail Adams and John?
Well, they were New Englanders through and through, and they were Congregationalists. And John, as president, proclaimed, and this was a little bit controversial, but proclaimed days of thanksgiving, basically religious proclamations. So there was always an element of that in their writings, in their political thought. Abigail's sister Elizabeth was particularly religious in her letters, and they're filled with biblical allusions.
Right. I'd go so far as to say that probably every letter mentions something religious. We'd have to do a study to prove that, but I'm just looking at another passage here. This is from a letter from Abigail to John on March 1776. And this goes back to my previous comment about the fact that both Abigail and John thought that maybe the declaration should have come a year sooner. And she's kind of noting the maybe the hypocrisy of some of the Southerners. She says, "I have sometimes been ready to think that the passion for liberty cannot be equally strong in the breasts of those who have been accustomed to deprive their fellow creatures of theirs, of their liberty. Of this, I am certain that it is not founded upon that generous and Christian principle of doing to others as we would that others should do unto us." And there's a lot going on in this passage. First, there's this critique of the southern states, primarily the southern states and some northern states, who did not want to become independent or join together as United States. Secondly, we see an early critique of slavery. And thirdly, we have also this theme of religion. She says this is a Christian principle. You should treat others as you want to be treated. And I don't see that in my Southern colleagues. So how do you see all those three themes working together in John and Abigail's lives?
Well, slavery was present in New England during the childhoods of John and Abigail. Abigail's father owned slaves. Slavery was outlawed in Massachusetts in 1783. But you're right, the divide that would grow ever wider until the Civil War was present then, and slavery was the key point. And the partisanship that we see throughout American history was very present as well. The Virginia factions were a political gulf apart from New England and the Adamses.
Right. So can you talk maybe a little bit now, since I brought it up, a little bit more about Abigail and John Adams' attitude towards slavery? Did it evolve over the course of the years? I mean, Abigail grew up with enslaved people in her own household, but here, at least by 1776, she's indicating in this letter that she thinks it's wrong.
They opposed slavery, yes, throughout their adult lives. John and Abigail did. One person who was enslaved in her father's household, Phoebe, lived with them throughout her life until she died in 1812. And Abigail calls her a third parent. There's a wonderful passage in a letter where Abigail describes advocating for a young African-American man named James who wanted to attend the neighborhood school and was not allowed to after complaints from neighbors of the Adamses, and Abigail would have none of it. She went to the head of the school and, well, let me read the letter. Perhaps that's an easier way to say it. The boy is a freeman as much as any of the young men, and merely because his face is black, is he to be denied instruction? How is he to be qualified to procure a livelihood? Is this the Christian principle of doing to others as we would have others do to us? Again, she's using that phrase. And she reports to John, this is in 1797, that he was allowed to attend school and she heard no more about the subject. So it's just a small illustration of her thinking on that subject.
But not only her thinking, if she advocated for him and got a result, it shows that she's changing minds and, you know, she wields enough influence at this point to say, like, hey, I'm telling you, let this kid go to school, right?
Absolutely, yes. And she did that in small ways in her personal life and as much as she could publicly, yes.
Okay, so it seems pretty clear that Abigail and John Adams were opposed to slavery in favor of allowing African Americans to get their education, which is a Christian principle, she indicates. How do we start to think about her advocacy for women and women's rights? How would you kind of construct that argument?
Her letters talk about how important education is to her, and she advocates for the young women that are close to her, her nieces, her cousins, to educate themselves as much as possible. And that's really the focus of, during her life, of her advocacy, I think, on a private level.
So women's education primarily.
Yes.
But not the women's right to vote.
Well, that was really not something that she publicly talked about. I don't think that she really considered it a practical thing at that point. So she doesn't really talk about that. There was an early movement in New Jersey during her lifetime that where they briefly allowed women to vote, and she comments on that a little bit, I believe. But it just wasn't something that would be taken seriously at that point, unfortunately.
Yeah, and at that point in history, except in New Jersey, there was that period, as you said, where all white adults, or maybe white property-holding adults, had the right to vote. But certainly, the blanket women's right to vote in 1776, 80, 90 was not something that most people would have agreed with. Okay, so back to women's rights in general. So yes for women's education, ambiguous, ambivalent, or not going to say publicly that women should have the right to vote. But there's this third idea that I think is interesting, because you mentioned that Abigail Adams controlled her own investments. So that's a big issue then, third issue for women is who controls their wealth, right? So what did she think about women and owning their own property, managing their own wealth in general?
Well, ironically, she had to draw on the assistance of her uncle, Cotton Tufts, to invest in her name, and he did so. There's some irony there, but she made some pretty wise investments. This is something that historian Woody Holton has explored quite a lot. She made probably wiser investments than John Adams. She really enjoyed doing it. She was successful at it, and it's clearly something that she wanted the right to do. She owned some property that was inherited from her father with her sisters in Medford, and she and her sisters were the sole operators of that. They hired or leased the land to artisans, and that was her deal completely.
But generally speaking, she thought all women should have that right.
I would say yes. She would agree with that statement, yes.
Well, no, I'm just trying to get to the sense that, you know, to what extent is Abigail Adams representative of lots of, let's say, white women at the time, and to what extent is she really unique? You know, is she the only woman investing, or is that common? Just trying to get a sense of to what extent Abigail is representative of women in general at the time.
I don't know of any other women of the time who were investing on their own, making their own decisions. I mean, again, just have to look at the next generation, and John Quincy did all of that and often didn't even advise his wife on what he was doing. These were funds that she set aside for herself, and John was overseeing the bulk of the finances of the family, but she was indeed investing on her own. And I do think it's almost unique as to my knowledge.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, let's jump ahead now to John Adams' presidency. And there's a lot of evidence that John relied on Abigail quite a bit for advice. So maybe you just want to read a passage or two about John and Abigail during John Adams's presidency.
Well, one of my favorite passages is from a letter that John wrote while he was in Philadelphia, and it was a time when Abigail had stayed behind. She usually came with him when he traveled for 6 or 8 months to the federal seat, but this time she stayed home.
And just to remind our audience, Philadelphia is the seat of Congress at the time.
Yeah, and he just makes it clear that he needs her advice. He wrote, "I must now repeat with zeal and earnestness, I can do nothing without you. I must entreat you to lose not a moment's time in preparing to come on. Assist me with your counsels and console me with your conversation. Everything related to the farms must be left to our friends."
Wow.
It just shows you that he depended on her.
Do you know what crises were happening for his presidency at the time when he wrote that?
He was just overwhelmed with paperwork, really what was going on at that point. I mean, the things that went on during his presidency was the quasi-war with France. Whether that's what he was writing particularly about, I'm not sure. It was America's conflict with France, which he headed off. He managed to head off by the end of his presidency. But I think it just illustrates that her political advice was very important to him.
Yeah, I love that passage. Okay, so we know that Abigail Adams had this very deep relationship with her politician husband, but she also had her own independent relationships with other important politicians in this period, including Thomas Jefferson. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Abigail's relationship with Jefferson?
Yeah, Abigail had an independent friendship with Jefferson. They clearly respected each other and considered each other friends. John and Thomas Jefferson, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, had their political differences and didn't leave on too good terms at the end of John's presidency. and ceased writing letters to each other at that point. And it was Abigail, 4 years later in 1804, that upon the death of Mary Jefferson Epps, Thomas Jefferson's daughter, she and he exchanged 7 letters and essentially reopened the conversation between the families. And what's really remarkable is that there's a notation on the last letter. It's dated November 19th, 1804, and it's John Adams's hand. And he wrote, as if for posterity, "The whole of this correspondence was begun and conducted without my knowledge or suspicion. Last evening and this morning, at the desire of Mrs. Adams, I read the whole. I have no remarks to make upon it at this time and in this place. J. Adams." It's pretty incredible that Abigail would write those letters and make this step without the knowledge of her husband, but his notation suggests that he was cool to the idea, but didn't really have a problem with it, which I think is quite remarkable.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Okay, we've been talking a lot about Abigail Adams as a wife of a president, as a friend of other presidents and politicians. Why don't we focus now just on her identity as a parent and as a grandparent? What should we remember about Abigail in that respect?
Well, Abigail and John loved all their kids, but they did play favorites. There's just no two ways around it. There's a letter in May of 1794 that Abigail wrote to John. In it, she described her kids. She said, "I will not say that all my geese are smart. I hope, however, that I have no occasion to blush for the conduct of any of my children. Perhaps I build more expectation upon the rising fame and reputation of one of them than of another. But where much is given, much shall be required. I know their virtues, and I'm not blind to their failings." So that one son was John Quincy Adams. They played favorites, and John Quincy did the same with his sons. His son Charles Francis Adams would go on to become a renowned politician in his own right. But it seemed to be the pattern of the family that one son was expected to excel.
To what extent was Abigail involved in John Quincy Adams' presidency?
No, she was gone by that time.
Okay.
So yeah, she died in 1818. But Abigail advised John Quincy just as she did her husband, and he valued it just as much. They write long political letters to each other and really get into an analysis of the political situations as it evolves during the years, and it's quite remarkable.
Interesting. Okay, so we've seen Abigail has these robust relationships with all sorts of people. She is influencing her own community, getting a black kid in school, but she's doing all these other things as well. She's also fascinated in science and in gardening. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about those passions of hers?
Well, it's the really wonderful thing about the Adams Papers collection. It's really a national treasure, and it's unsurpassed in its scope and preservation. And it's valuable to historians far beyond history. There's everything in there. There's food history, there's medicine, as you mentioned, smallpox. There's history of technology, the movement west, Native Americans, South American politics. But one of the things that I most enjoy is the little tidbits of science that appear. In 1800, there was a really bizarre occurrence across the eastern seaboard. They hear about it in New York, where what they called brimstone was landing as a fine powder on everything. And we did a little research here and have a note suggesting that it might have been from an 1800 eruption of Mount St. Helens on the West Coast, which would have sent ash across the United States. Just a little connection that we invite historians to delve into if they want to. JQA, John Quincy Adams, talks about observing an eclipse, a total eclipse of the sun, which actually was expected. The scientists expected it to happen. It did right on time in June 1806. The present volume we're working on talks about the New Madrid earthquake, and Abigail comments on hearing reports of that from the south. And the Great Comet of 1811 is is talked about. John goes out to observe it. So lots of good stuff in there beyond politics.
Great. And what about gardening?
Well, the gardens at the family estate, and I invite listeners, if they're interested, to visit the National Historic Park in Quincy, where the house is preserved and with all of the artifacts that the Adamses owned. And the gardens there continue, including with rose plants that Abigail planted, still flourish there. And one thing that always amused me is that Abigail declined to plant a flower called the Crown Imperial because she says it bears too monarchical a name to find admittance to the catalog of a humble citizen. So politics even got into her gardens there. So.
She is an elite. It's funny. She is an elite, but, you know, there was that sense, that Massachusetts sense, that you could be an elite, but it was through your own effort and hard work, not through hereditary privilege, which I think we need to remember, too.
You described their mindset very well right there. Yeah, they did all the work. They had servants, but they were working right along with them and the pleasure in it.
All right, Hobson, we're coming to an end. There's one passage from one letter that I wanted to read to end my portion, and then I'll give you the last word to reflect on the Declaration of Independence after 250 years. But I thought this passage from a letter from Abigail to John on the 21st of July, 1776, so just a couple weeks after the Declaration of Independence. She writes this to John, who is, I believe, still in Philadelphia. She says, "Last Thursday," so it would have been the 18th of July, "after hearing a very good sermon," so she's at church, so she's often at church, "I went with the multitude into King Street to hear the proclamation for independence read and proclaimed. Some field pieces with the train were brought there. The troops appeared under arms, and all the inhabitants assembled there." She notes in parentheses, "The smallpox prevented many thousands from the country from attending. When Colonel Crafts read from the balcony of the State House the proclamation, great attention was given to every word. As soon as he ended, the cry from the balcony was, 'God save our American states!' And then three cheers which rended the air. The bells rang, the privateers fired, the forts and batteries, the cannon were discharged, the platoons followed, and every face appeared joyful. Mr. Bowden then gave a sentiment, 'Stability and perpetuity to American independence.' After dinner, the king's arms were taken down from the State House, and every vestige of him from every place in which it appeared, and burnt in King Street. Thus ends royal authority in this state, and all the people shall say amen." I mean, what a crazy letter to write to your husband. I just think it's fantastic. There's so much good stuff in there. Anyway, that's me ending my part of this episode. But I want to give you the last word, Hobson. As you think about the Declaration of Independence 250 years away, what are your major takeaways?
Well, I think you're right. That letter just communicates the excitement and the real realization on her part that she's witnessing an amazing event, the birth of America. And I think she knew it and was excited about it. But I think what it really meant to her was an opportunity for more equal rights for Americans. I mean, I hearken back to her letter to John about remembering the ladies when he worked on the Declaration of Independence, and her advocacy for the young African-American man who wanted to go to school. It was an opportunity for equal rights, and I think that's the thing that really excited her.
And it should excite us today. Hobson Woodward, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.